probably haven't heard of Colonel John Park Finley, James Pollard Espy, Robert Hare, and Cleveland Abbey. You may not even have known their names if you lived in the late 19th century, but they were among the first Americans to become obsessed with tornadoes. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Early on, there wasn't even a word for these often violent, destructive storms. They were sometimes called whirlwinds, land spouts, or cyclones. A man fascinated by the weather, Benjamin Franklin, used the word tornado only once. But there was a determined group of men, including the Storm King, James Espy, who were determined to learn all they could about these extreme weather events. This hour, I'll talk to Lee Sandlin, author of the new book, Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. But first, the news. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, sitting in for Charity Nebbe. It's amazing how much we've learned about the weather, but it's only in the last few decades that we've made some real headway into understanding the science behind wind, rain, and storms. And then there's the misconceptions about tornadoes, for example. Even until the early 1950s, forecasters didn't take them very seriously. And the advice to open your windows and get to the southwest corner of the lowest level of a building has now been shown to be wrong. But it doesn't mean that a number of people haven't been obsessed with trying to learn the truth about the weather in America, going back to Benjamin Franklin. You know, the experiment he and his son did with a kite during a thunderstorm. Later in the 19th century, there were several men who were obsessed with the subject. One, James Espy, now known as the Storm King, is considered America's first meteorologist. Lee Sandlin, author of the acclaimed Wicked River, has written about this group who rarely got along but managed to slowly advance the science of weather, although the understanding of tornadoes was extremely slow to develop. Lee Sandlin's new book is Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's Tornado Chasers. Sandlin, who lives in Chicago, is in Iowa on his book tour. Lee Sandlin, welcome. Nice to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be here.
The Storm Kings, there was a number of them, but one in particular, and you have decided to give that title to one James Espy, who for a very long time was truly obsessed with trying to understand the weather. What's his story?
He was somebody who was, his background was that he was originally a school teacher, but he was like a lot of the earliest scientists, an enthusiastic amateur. And he became, as you say, obsessed with figuring out the weather, particularly violent American weather. And he made a number of major breakthroughs conceptually in the understanding of weather, including the crucial one about how storms do form. He was also a very theatrical man. He was a very eager self-promoter. He wanted to be known as America's first professional meteorologist. And he traveled around the country, in fact, talking about his ideas, some of which were brilliant and some of which struck his earliest listeners as insane. And he became an enormous celebrity. He was a friend of Emerson's. Nathaniel Hawthorne mentioned him. What now would be like a superstar of the weather.
A superstar of the weather, he was. But he had a group of, and they were all men.
Right, yeah.
Who were also obsessed with the weather.
Yeah.
He didn't seem to get along with too many of these guys.
No, he really didn't. And it's sort of a shame because a lot of people now look back and say the fights he had with other meteorologists basically paralyzed the study of weather in America for a couple of decades after his initial breakthroughs. He saw the subject of weather as not just as a field for scientific investigation, but also really in a lot of ways for public entertainment. And so he was always eager to pick a fight with anybody who disagreed with him. He spent a couple of decades in a major feud with another really pretty brilliant early scientist. His name is William Redfield, and they violently disagreed about the nature of tornadoes.
Mm.
They had what they thought of as absolutely opposite views about how tornadoes formed and what they were. And Espy actually wanted to turn that into a form of entertainment. He wanted to travel the country with Redfield and debate him publicly. Redfield was a little too shy to do it, but they kept up their feud for 20 years.
this misunderstanding of the nature of tornadoes, which took decades, and we're I'm not even sure if we've totally figured it out today.
No, we haven't actually. It's some of the key questions about tornadoes are still mysterious.
But they seem to disagree a lot about whether tornadoes actually rotated. Now, it seems so obvious to us today, and Redfield seemed to be more accurate on this, wasn't he?
Well, that's a really fascinating part of this debate, is that both Espy and Redfield were right, but they couldn't concede anything to the other side. Espy had understood a fundamental truth about weather. He was the first person, as far as I can tell, who really grasped the basic principle of how violent storms form, which is that they're rising columns of hot air into cold air, and that clash causes tornadoes to form. Redfield was the first person to understand that large forms of storms like hurricanes rotate. Nobody had really known that before. It seems obvious to us now because we're used to satellite photographs. But then if you think about it, the only observations people had were from ground level of a storm passing overhead. And the fact that a storm rotated was not at all obvious. And the truth is that tornadoes both are rising columns of air and rotating columns of air. Neither one of these two guys was able to see that there was any merit at all on the other side. And that fight drew in most of the scientists in America in this feud that lasted, as I say, for about 20 years.
It does seem obvious to us today that they rotate. But then again, you said we can see video, we can see photographs, and they just didn't have access to that. In fact, you have a couple of wonderful photographic sections in the book.
Sure,
And one, I think, the very first photograph of a tornado from, what, the 1880s?
The 1880s, taken in the Great Plains.
And it turns up on a postcard.
Sure, It's a very dramatic image. I think I'm pretty sure the image was very heavily retouched to make it more dramatic. But if you see it, it's unforgettable. It's they called really severe tornadoes the finger of God. And this photo really gives you that feeling. You can get a sense of how terrifying tornadoes were to the people when they were first venturing out into the Great Plains and seeing them. They did know about tornadoes by that point, and there were rare phenomena on the East Coast, but the Great Plains, the big supercell tornadoes, they didn't discover, Americans didn't discover until the colonists began venturing out across the prairie.
And that's because the Great Plains weren't really settled for later, and that's where a lot of the tornadoes touched down.
That's where the worst tornadoes in America are,
And so a lot of these men, and again, we're talking about Espy and others, Redfield, they were interested in tornadoes, but the public really wasn't, because they just weren't well known, and there was a lot of misconceptions about how frequent tornadoes were.
Sure,
many people then were saying, "Well, they happen so rarely that we don't even need to worry about them." And
that was actually the government position about tornadoes throughout a lot of the 19th century. They were attempting to allay people's fears about tornadoes because they didn't want to discourage real estate investment, people from building in the Midwest. And so they said, oh, no, tornadoes are very rare. I found an estimate from the guy who was in charge of the National Weather Service in Iowa, for instance, in the 1890s, who said, we only have one tornado a year in Iowa.
Well, you know, I read that and I thought, this is really interesting, because I happen to I have a collection of his weather journals that I found at a flea market.
Yeah.
Gustav Hendricks.
Yes.
And the journals are very meticulous and well thought out.
He wasn't a fool by any means. Yeah, no, he was a great meteorologist.
So why didn't he understand tornadoes?
Well, he may have actually understood them more than he was willing to admit. They were under a huge amount of pressure in those days, not only from their higher-ups, but from business interests and real estate people in the Midwest to downplay the dangers of tornadoes.
So that same thing, downplay the dangers. We don't want to scare people away from buying our land and moving in.
Yeah. And he may also – I mean, tornadoes are actually quite rare in a lot of ways. I mean, you could live in the Midwest your entire life and not see one.
I've never seen one myself. Have you seen one?
Yeah, I was in one and I've seen a couple. But, yeah, I know a lot of people who've never seen them. And so it wasn't insane to argue that they were rare. You know, it was not terribly responsible to try to ignore the threat, but you can't really – well, you can blame them, but the position was not baffling, if you know what I mean. It wasn't berserkly insane or something. It was a general preoccupation, or that attitude, tornadoes aren't a big threat, was a basic assumption of the National Weather Service until after World War II, really.
You know, that was one of the things I learned from your book that really shocked me.
Yeah.
I just could not believe that they waited until the early 50s to even really talk about tornadoes much.
Yeah, and there's long stretches. If you look through the archives of the National Weather Service, it's not just that they weren't talking, they weren't even keeping records about them. Estimating things like how frequent they were would have been impossible from the records they were keeping like early in the 20th century.
Lee, you say in your introduction that, and we just talked about this, but in the area of the country where tornadoes are most common, and that's Oklahoma, Kansas, Iowa, the region known as Tornado Alley, a really violent tornado is rare. You know, we need to maybe remind ourselves of that once in a while so we're not quite so anxious about, our house being swept away. But, you know, when we tune into the news, it seems like every day starting in about February, really, there's tornadoes here and there, and sometimes there can be, 20, 30 tornadoes in a day across the United States.
Yeah.
So there's certainly no more tornadoes today than there were back in the 19th century.
No, that's true. The numbers of tornadoes appear right now to be pretty much constant. There's about 1,300 tornado touchdowns a year in the Central Plains.
And so global warming, if you accept that, is not contributing to more tornadoes?
That's a very hotly debated question right now. It does not appear from the numbers that tornado frequency correlates with global warming. But whether that's going to prove to be true over the long haul, nobody knows. We're going to find out. Maybe that's not a good thing that we're going to find out, but we will find out whether instability in the global weather patterns leads to more tornadoes.
Lee, we need to take a short break. We're going to get back to our conversation about your book, Storm Kings, in just a minute. I'm talking to Lee Sandlin. His new book, Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. And Talk of Iowa continues in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, and I'm speaking to Lee Sandlin, the author of the acclaimed Wicked River. His new book is about the history of meteorology in America, actually going all the way back to Benjamin Franklin. We'll talk about Benjamin Franklin in just a second. Lee Sandlin is in Iowa on his book tour. He spoke last night at Prairie Lights Books in Iowa City. You start with a chapter called The Electricians, and you say, among the popular entertainers and traveling acts in 18th century America were performers known as electricians. So,
yeah.
I was really surprised to read about this. What do these guys do?
Well, science has always been half about the pure knowledge and half about public entertainment. And these guys were exploiting for theatrical effects the properties of static electricity, which in the early 18th century were completely mysterious and still can startle people now. A good demonstration of static electricity where you can get lightning bolts to crackle out of people's heads, I mean, that can still surprise people. And in that era where no one knew anything about the nature of electricity, it became very easy for people to become successful when exploiting some basic properties of the physics of electricity.
Science as entertainment.
Sure, yeah.
Well, let's jump up to Benjamin Franklin.
Sure.
I mean, what a guy.
Yeah, he's amazing. What a guy. Yeah, I mean, we have this image of him as this kind of dull guy advocating prudence and responsibility and financial management and all the rest of this. And he was much more colorful than that. He was a pretty grandly risk-taking, adventurous guy intellectually.
And for a while, he was very interested in weather.
Yeah, he had a certain tendency to take up subjects and become completely obsessed with them for a few years.
And then move on.
Yeah, and then get bored and move on. But he did spend 4 or 5 years spellbound by the nature of weather, and especially of violent weather.
What years?
Would be 1750 and then following couple of years.
And as you say, he never actually used the word tornado.
No.
And that's interesting in itself, because the word tornado was not all that common until when? Into the early 20th century?
Well, the strange thing is that the word was around before anybody came to apply it to what we now call a tornado. The word actually goes back to the early 17th century. It was a word that British sailors used to describe storms at sea. But the thing that's fascinating to me about that period is that people did not really realize that storms took on any kind of different forms, that there was a difference between a tornado and a hurricane, for instance. That was not at all obvious in that era, so they tended to use the same words to describe all kinds of different storms.
And there were, as you say, a number of words used to describe actual tornadoes.
Yeah, tornado, hurricane, gale, cyclone. These were all used interchangeably, sometimes in more than one in the same sentence to describe a tornado.
When was the first tornado to be widely publicized, where the entire country knew about it and you could open up your newspaper and find an account of it?
That was actually a tornado that happened in New Jersey in the 1830s. And it was the first tornado that was widely studied. And it happened in a town in New Jersey, New Brunswick. And a number of the leading scientists of the day traveled to the town to look at the wreckage, and it became written about in most of the newspapers of America. So that was the first time that it really sank into the public consciousness.
Did ESPE show up to look around?
ESPE was there. Redfield was there. All of the big tornado experts were there. They spent the summer going around annoying the locals with questions about what the storm would have been like. They arrived like about a week after the storm, and they spent months there trying to figure out what had happened.
Well, what actually happened? I mean, can you recount the story of that tornado in New Jersey?
Well, it was a classic tornado. It touched down in the countryside outside of New Brunswick and then came through the city and caused a panic because nobody had any idea what it was. I mean, other than the fact that tornadoes tend to cause panics anyway, since they had really nothing to go on, this mysterious black cloud coming through the city destroying everything, they thought it was a very fast-moving fire, for instance. A lot of the fire alarms went off. And it was a very typical tornado in that it left a trail of destruction behind. But it was the first time that it happened in America in any kind of population center. There had been a lot of reports of tornadoes in the 18th century, but they were mostly all in very rural areas because that was the truth of America then. It was almost all farmland and forest. There were very few settlements then through the early years of the American Republic.
And so what was the outcome of this tornado? Did people demand that the government start doing some research and try to figure out what happened here and what could be done to prevent this again?
No, that only happened later. At the time, it was viewed as pretty much of a freak event. The scientists were very excited by it, but the notion that it was something that tornadoes were something the government could concern itself with really only happened in a big way after the Civil War. That was when the Midwest started getting settled, and that was when the government actually became active in researching tornadoes. And when the United States Signal Corps, who was at that point had taken over responsibility for predicting the weather, was traveling around, they would send people out to the heartland to investigate severe storms. And that was when they began hearing from people, is there anything to be done about this? What are these storms? What kind of preparations we could take? A lot of the misconceptions about tornadoes that persisted well into the 20th century, into my own childhood, for instance, kind of originated there. The idea about hiding in the southwest corner of the basement, mm-hmm. the idea of opening up the windows when a tornado, mm-hmm. those go back to the 1870s and 1880s. There was never any evidence to suggest that that was true, but that was those were ideas that were being floated around then.
Well, they thought that the tornado was really just a big area of low pressure. And then,
yeah.
So if you opened your windows, you would equalize the pressure.
Exactly. They were trying to account for how incredibly destructive tornadoes are in a very small amount of time. And the best theory they could come up with was that there had to be a vacuum at the heart of the funnel cloud. And when it passed over a building, the air pressure would push outward and blow the building up. We now know that's completely false. Tornado damage is entirely caused by wind speed, winds being drawn into the funnel.
Why did it take researchers and scientists so long to figure that out? Because I was still hearing that when I was a young adult.
Yeah, when in the 1970s, 1980s.
Yeah,
you can still hear it now, actually. Part of it was that tornadoes, up until the advent of video, were very hard it's hard to get eyewitnesses out to see them. It was especially hard to get trained eyewitnesses to out there to study them. And it was really only with the advent of serious tornado chasing with high gear radar, mm-hmm. for instance, people began to get a glimpse of what the interior of a storm was like and began to figure out the dynamics of the storm. Because it just wasn't obvious before. I mean, they're very quick. They're very ephemeral. A lot of tornadoes can travel 40 or 50 miles an hour, which means they can pass through a town and be gone before even and it's time to register what had happened.
So many of the people in your book, eyewitnesses, described the tornadoes, even though they didn't really understand what they were, as being of strange colors. And I found that very perplexing. One person would say it was a red mass, and it was a green mass. And it was, I don't ever recall today people talking about a strange red mass coming down over the plains.
That is one of the mysteries. You can find reports like that into the 1980s of trained observers seeing strange lights. But the thing is that we now have a huge body of tornado videos, and not one of them has shown any of these lights. So what were they seeing? And that's a question that I don't really know. You can suppose that it was a reaction to just how startling a tornado looks. Maybe they were confusing it with lightning. Who knows? But those reports are remarkably persistent, but they've faded out now that there's been replaced by video.
Talking today on Talk of Iowa to Lee Sandlin. His book is Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. I found it interesting, Lee, that much of the meteorology of for decades was, as you mentioned, a part of the Signal Corps, which was actually part of the U.S. Army.
Yes.
So this was a military service.
It was. It was. It was for a number of years. And the idea was originally the Smithsonian Institution was the first American government agency or to take an interest in tornadoes and in violent weather, keeping track of weather generally. But after the Civil War, the Smithsonian gave up that, and through a lot of kind of strange political maneuvering, the Signal Corps took it over. The Signal Corps, it was an outfit that was essentially looking for a job. After the Civil War, there really wasn't much use for them, and they thought doing something like taking over weather forecasting would give them the kind of political clout to survive. So that was basically the motive behind taking it over. And they ran the weather service for many decades.
Well, part of the history of all of this was of the Secretary of War, the son of Abraham Lincoln, Robert Lincoln. He was involved in this and got into some really strong debates over where the weather forecasters should be located, Army, civilian. What was his story?
Well, one of the things that I found most fascinating researching this book, I don't know whether it's consoling or not, is that American politics hasn't really changed that much since the 19th century. And the American government, especially in the years after the Civil War, was engaged in these endless bureaucratic infighting over who had authority and who didn't. And Robert Lincoln, who was Secretary of the Army after or Secretary of War after the Civil War, got into a brutal fight with the head of the Signal Corps over who was in charge of the weather and what responsibility the Signal Corps had. And it's a kind of a fascinating and complicated story that doesn't really shed very much favorable light on any of the participants, but it's very typical about how things that seem like neutral science can end up be bitterly politicized.
And they fought and they fought and they fought.
Yeah.
And, of course, years later, the National Weather Service was established.
Right, and that was kind of a legacy of Robert Lincoln, who kind of set it up so that even after he left Washington, his political clout remained, and he was able to give a shaft to the military control of the weather and get it transferred to the new Department of Agriculture. And now it's under the control of the Department of the Interior. And these fights keep on going on. You know, it's always politicized, even when you think it's just weather. What kind of politics could you make out of it?
Well, there were some horrendous tornadoes you talk about in the book, starting in the 1830s. Then you talk about the just incredible phenomenon of the tri-state
tornado. That was 1925.
An extremely long-lived tornado.
Sure.
That went on for, hours and hours?
4 hours. Yeah, the average tornado lasts for about 20 minutes. And this one held together for 4 hours. It started in Missouri. It crossed all of Illinois and it went into Indiana. Over the course of that afternoon, it killed more than 900 people.
What are some of the other tornadoes that really stand out in the history?
Well, the strangest one that I write about is one that happened in the town of Peshtigo in Wisconsin, which was – and there's a lot of debate about what actually happened. But essentially, there was an enormous fire in Peshtigo. It was the same night as the Great Chicago Fires that happens. There was a huge drought in the Great Lakes region then. And that firestorm was so intense that it spawned its own weather system, and a tornado appears to have touched down in the middle of it. And it drew flames up from the fire. So people saw a tornado made of fire crossing through the forest and destroying this town.
This was a truly stunning situation.
Yeah, there's only been a few recorded like it in history.
I just couldn't believe it when I was reading this, that this happened.
Isn't it amazing, really?
Tremendous loss of life, and I thought at first when I read this, it wasn't really a tornado, it was just this horrendous firestorm.
Right.
But there were incredible explosions, and many, many people died. What is the explanation for it now, looking back?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that even now as to what happened. Now, the version I give in the book, I reconstructed from eyewitness testimony at the time. Now, people still think, is this something that actually happens? Because it really kind of sounds like something that would happen on another planet more than it would on Earth. But there have been videos taken of small fire tornadoes forming in intense forest fires. So the phenomenon does appear to exist. I found a report from Australia about 10 years ago of an intense firestorm during a drought in which nobody saw a tornado, but in the wreckage afterwards, they found the unmistakable track of a tornado that formed at the heart of this fire. So they do appear to exist. They're quite rare, but their action is completely catastrophic.
And there was no place to escape. In fact, some people tried to jump in the river.
Yeah, the only survivors in the town were people who were in the river. A lot of the river was so cold then a lot of people froze to death. And the other thing that happened was that people were so spellbound by the sight of this thing bearing down on them that they lingered and they kept staring at it. And a lot of them had permanent damage to their eyesight from just being unable to look away from this thing as it was coming down on the town.
And then what was the connection between this incredible event at Peshtigo, Wisconsin, and the Great Chicago Fire?
Well, I think it's just simply a consequence of the fact that there was a huge drought going on then, and there was very little in the way of fire departments. You know, most cities, including Chicago, had very rudimentary fire control. And so it was just an unlucky fluke that major fires broke out both in Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan. There was a huge fire across Lake Michigan in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan at the same time. So it was a very bad night, that one night, and not a night that really was very happy for the Great Lakes.
Lee Sandlin, hold on. This is really, really fascinating. Need to take another break, and we will be back in just a minute talking to Lee Sandlin, author of The Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. He's in Iowa on his book tour. Be back in a minute when Talk of Iowa continues. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, talking to Lee Sandlin. A fascinating book just out called Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. And Lee, this is it's a horrific book to read in some cases, that we were talking about this incredible firestorm in near Green Bay in 1871, other massive tornadoes. But the history of these men who started to investigate all of this is really very, very interesting. And one thing comes up. In the 19th century, many homes were equipped with tornado cellars or storm cellars or something that people built, usually out in the yard underground, that were equipped with some food and a table and some candles. And you just don't see that anymore. And I'm wondering whatever happened to those.
That's really kind of a shame, actually, because not just the 19th century, but through a lot of the first half of the 20th century, they were very common in Tornado Alley. People on farms, people in towns would build tornado cellars. That seems to have dropped out. It's also not just that those have dropped away. Most new construction in the Midwest, residential homes don't have basements, they don't have interior closets, they don't have the most elementary protection against storms. And it appears to be just this collective belief that it's not really an issue anymore, which is a catastrophically dangerous belief.
It certainly is, given the Joplin, the Missouri.
The Joplin is a huge example. Everything about tornado prediction worked as it was supposed to in Joplin. They had more than 20 minutes warning. The alarms went off everywhere, and people had no idea what to do. And even when they did have an idea, there was no place to take shelter. It seems in a lot of ways, I don't want to be a pessimist, but it's very hard to look at stories like that and think that we're not going backwards.
Incredible loss of life.
In
Joplin. And you talk a lot about the Joplin tornado and the fact that, as you just said, the science worked fine. The Weather Service knew exactly what was going to happen. There was at least 20 minutes of warning for that tornado. And
it didn't matter. There was a really bad storm came through Chicago a few years ago, and they set off the tornado warning sirens because there were reports of radar of circulation in the clouds. My wife was at a subway, or was on an elevated platform, and said that nobody in the platform had any idea what the sirens meant. And this is in the middle of the Midwest, where tornado preparation is supposed to be a basic part of our education. No one had any idea what it meant or what to do.
Lee, you even talk about how the Native Americans dealt in 200 years ago. Dealt with tornadoes. Very interesting. A man went along with a group of a man, an observer, you talk about, went along and lived with the Miami Indians, who at that time were in the Oklahoma.
They were in western Kansas.
Western Kansas.
Yeah.
And they obviously, for hundreds of years were well aware of tornadoes.
And they were.
They had a system in place, sort of, to deal with.
They had a lot of practical wisdom about how to deal with tornadoes, how to survive them, how to dig trenches and lie flat when a tornado passed overhead. On the other hand, it's also true that they told the white settlers at a time when they were still willing to give white settlers advice that the safest way to build a settlement was at the junction of two rivers because tornadoes wouldn't pass over water, which is entirely false. And it suggests that the tradition of expert advice on tornadoes being wrong goes back quite a long way.
Well, let's jump ahead because it's the history of tornadoes that's really so interesting in your new book. And let's move up to the era of General Hazen. His name was General William Hazen. He had a very dictatorial and opinionated view of where weather should go, weather forecasting go.
Yeah.
And first of all, just tell us briefly about him. He's a very interesting character.
Yeah, he was kind of a hothead. He'd come up through the ranks of the army and had gotten into a lot of trouble with his superiors. He was continually fighting with them. And, in fact, one of the fights saved his life because he was an assistant to General Custer. And because he'd fought so much with him, Custer wouldn't bring him along on the expedition that ended at Little Bighorn. He became head of the Signal Corps. He was in some ways quite a good administrator, in that he defended his people. And he took a lot of interest in tornadoes because he had never really heard about them before. He'd spent a lot of time on the Great Plains, but he'd never seen one. And he was amazed to be reading these reports of tornadoes destroying towns in the Midwest. So he was one of the first people in the government to encourage a lot of basic research on weather, especially on tornadoes.
And there was another Hazen that came in, his nephew, Harold, and he was the guy that came up with the idea of the tornado trap, which was building a line of lookout stations along a town's western boundary, each connected by wire with caches of dynamite. I'm just reading from your book. And then when you see the funnel cloud approaching, the operator would wait and then touch off the cartridge and blow the tornado to smithereens.
Yeah, he thought that was a brilliant idea. Yeah, he thought that would really work. He got into a lot of trouble for that because he was quite serious about these ideas, even though everybody in the National Weather Service thought he was kind of crazy. And he would give interviews after major tornadoes and say, well, if only they'd followed my ideas, nobody would have died. Ultimately, they silenced him for that. He was one of these guys who you often come across in organizations who thought of himself as the skeptic. And his idea was to shoot down whatever the reigning consensus is. So he became their leading authority on tornadoes, even though almost every bit of wisdom that had been accumulated about tornadoes in the past couple of centuries, he didn't believe any of it. He didn't believe tornadoes rotated. He didn't believe the air went up in a tornado. He didn't believe there was there was low pressure at the heart of a tornado. He didn't believe anything that anybody had established about them. He thought the dangers of tornadoes were wildly overrated. He thought you could get within like 10 or 15 yards of a tornado in perfect safety.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very dangerous and irresponsible guy. But, that was an era where anybody who proclaimed himself an expert pretty much was taken as face value. Not necessarily we've made a lot of progress since then.
Well, one of the things we've learned, and not to be skipping around throughout history here, but one of the things we've learned, and you talk about this, is that really the damage from tornadoes is from the wind. It's not low pressure. It's not electrical.
It's
gusty winds, and you grab and you talk a lot about what he was known then as Ted Fujita, Japanese.
Mr. Tornado.
We're still using the F.
The Fujita scale.
The Fujita scale.
F1 or F0 through F5.
But not to jump to the end of the book, but I just thought that was interesting that all of these theories, and then what it really comes down to is if the winds are blowing at 200 miles per hour, you've got problems.
Yeah, 300. Some of them go as high as 300 miles an hour. Gradually wisdom is accumulating about tornadoes that's undercutting people's assumptions. Almost all tornado fatalities are caused by flying debris, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And that means – that says a lot about where you should take shelter. An interior closet, for instance, is the best possible place to take shelter because that's the best place where you're not going to be hit by flying debris.
You even mentioned that you could be fatally injured by a piece of cardboard if it were
– traveling at 300 miles an hour.
Yeah,
that can go through a wall. A concrete wall, things develop extraordinarily powerful force when they're traveling that fast.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the popular conceptions or the images of tornadoes from the mass media. And, of course, the movie The Wizard of Oz comes to mind, 1939. That really did, in a lot of people's minds, give them their only real picture of what a tornado was supposed to look like.
Yeah, and the thing is they actually did take a lot of care to get it right. Tornadoes don't move really the way the funnel cloud moves in that movie, but it's not that wrong. And that's one of the reasons I think that movie is so unforgettable. They took a lot of trouble. It's a much more vivid scene, by the way, than the corresponding scene in the original Frank Baum novel. It's not actually that impressive a description in the novel. I don't think Baum had ever seen a tornado.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie is much more vivid than the book.
And he came up with the name Dorothy from what?
Dorothy Gale was the name of a victim of a tornado in 1878. And I think that he was struck, as almost anybody would be, by the irony of somebody named Dorothy Gale being killed by a tornado. And so that's one of the reasons why Dorothy in the book got that name. Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the movie Twister from the 80s. We all want to see that.
Yeah.
Helen Hunt.
Right.
Bill Paxton. Right. What about that version of a tornado?
It's pretty silly. It's not totally wrong. They tried to get stuff right, but it's a pretty goofy movie. It's straight Hollywood. I wouldn't say it's a bad time, but, and they did make some effort to get the tornadoes to at least look right. But, that's not what storm chasing is like.
Yeah.
You don't tend to see 10 tornadoes a day when you're out chasing.
I wanted to also ask you about the fog. I noticed in your book that many observers always reported fog before a tornado. And I didn't really understand what that's about because I never thought of there being a fog before a tornado.
That's a mysterious thing. Yeah, it happens in a few instances with really severe tornadoes. But one of the things that's always a problem with tornadoes is that we have a very clear idea of what they look like now because we've seen so much video. But before we had the video, you were often dealing with an extraordinarily confused sky and all sorts of strange fogs and mists and gusts at ground level. I was in a tornado when I was 17 years old. And I knew intellectually what I was going through, but I never saw a funnel cloud. I never saw any of the stuff that people normally report with tornadoes.
And where was this?
That was in Illinois, in this one of the suburbs of Chicago. It was a weak tornado, but it was still very, very frightening. Didn't cause any serious injuries, knocked down a lot of trees, stove in some rooftops. I was standing at the door of my house. I was about to go outside. It was this beautiful spring morning, and I had my hand actually on the doorknob of my front door, looking out the window, and everything on the street in an instant got pitch dark, and everything that wasn't nailed down went straight up into the air.
Wow.
But I could think to myself, this is what it's got to be. This has got to be a tornado. But that was only because I was interested in the subject and I'd read about them. If, 100 years earlier, if I'd been in the same situation, I wouldn't have the slightest idea what was happening to me.
Lee, did you ever think there would be the storm chasers that we see today? You talk about this in the book, people who go out with cars with shatterproof glass.
Yeah, tanks they're traveling around in now. Yeah. No, I never had any idea that would happen. It's a really fascinating development, isn't it?
It really is.
Tornadoes are spectator sports.
And you say maybe the biggest danger is that there's so many they may end up running into each other as they go chasing.
Yeah, somebody said that to me, that was now the greatest danger in tornado chasing is getting rear-ended by another chaser.
Talking now to Lee Sandlin, his book Storm Kings, let's talk about forecasting.
Yeah.
Because for decades and decades, I'm sure there was a push for the American public wanting accurate forecasts, but they didn't get accurate forecasts, weather forecasts, for a very long time. Even though the Signal Corps, later the Weather Service, sort of claimed to have accurate forecasts, but really until when was it that we got a forecast that you could actually trust?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question to answer, because you could make the case we're still not that far along at accurate tornado forecasting. What we have is a situation now where the Weather Service issues what they call watches for particular areas at risk to tornadoes. And those are quite accurate as far as they go. It's very rare for a tornado to touch down outside of what's called a watch box. But these watch boxes are very large areas comparatively. There's still no way of predicting a tornado at a specific time at a specific place. The tornado warnings that get issued are when there is evidence a tornado is already forming or is already formed. And so it's a warning for something that's already happening. Mm-hmm. And that's not really a prediction. And there's a lot of argument as to how possible, how far we can really take it in real time to be able to predict tornadoes. It's still an open question.
Well, in the very early days, they actually used telegraph wires, right, to send a message 100 miles down the telegraph line saying that there's severe weather on the way.
Sure. And we still have, you know, a more evolved version of that, but that's still how tornadoes, people find out about tornadoes. They find about tornadoes that are already on the ground. I mean, tornadoes in Oklahoma City in the 1990s, for instance, were tracked, and still are when they come close, tracked by helicopters in real time. So there's very little doubt about where a tornado is going to go. But you're still up against this problem about prediction. And that problem is still very, very tricky. I've talked to weather people who think that it might actually turn out to be impossible.
That's sort of discouraging to hear that.
Yeah, you want it to be. I mean, look, we're talking now, an hour from now, the National Weather Service might announce we've cracked the problem. So you don't know. But it's an incredibly difficult problem, because the worst tornadoes form in supercell thunderstorms, which are vast, chaotic weather systems, and tornadoes form in a very small space within those systems. So there may never be enough real-time information about what's happening in the storm to exactly predict a tornado forming. I would like to be wrong about that, but it is possible. We just will never be able to do it in practical terms.
You mentioned the super outbreak. Here's a case where
1974,
where almost 150 tornadoes touched down out of a single weather system.
Exactly. And which was thought at the time to be a freak event that might only happen once every 500 years. But we've had two outbreaks just as big since then. And so it's something that happens more often than we thought.
And the United States continues to be the place for tornadoes, right? Especially the plains. And you don't run into them very often in Europe, although
they're very rare in Europe. They do happen in Bangladesh. The conditions are right in Bangladesh because you have cold air coming off the Himalayas and warm air coming from the Indian Ocean. So they have been reported there. Weather reporting in that part of the world is very sketchy, so there isn't accurate data about how common they are. But they do happen there, and they have happened almost everywhere else. The freak conditions can arise that will produce them. The only place they happen routinely, though, is on the central plains of North America.
And Tornado Alley continues to be Kansas, Oklahoma.
Right, Iowa. Illinois, northern Texas. Probably been happening for 5,000-10,000 years in that part of the world. So, and no sign yet that it's going to let up.
Well, Lee Sandlett, thank you so much. It's really an interesting book. I really enjoyed reading about the history of meteorology, storm chasers, tornadoes in the United States. There's a lot of information here that I'm sure people will not be aware of. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Lee Sandlett is author of Storm Kings, The Untold History of America's First Tornado Chasers. He's in Iowa on his book tour. Talk of Iowa's executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And for Charity Nebbe, I'm Dennis Reese.